around the world. I'm John Batchelor. To Europe, to the United Kingdom, to positive, very, very promising headlines. Bloomberg. JP Morgan is first bank to predict UK will avoid recession. London Times. Brexit deal. Rishi Sunak tells DUP no changes to framework as it happened. Unionists claim EU agreement may not need reworking. Both these headlines require interpretation, and Joseph Sternberg is here to help me. Joe's in London for the journal, but at the same time, he is the one man I know in all my years of talking who can actually encapsulate both Brexit, the Tory conservative domination of Parliament, and the question of recession. He can put them all together. Joe, are these separate silos? Rishi's having a good day. They make a deal with the European Union about Northern Ireland, and they're going to avoid recession, says JP Morgan. Is that an accident?
Well, the two are sort of related because certainly lingering Brexit uncertainty has been a big drag on the UK economy. And so the deal that Rishi Sunak and the European Union announced this week hopefully will do a lot to alleviate the uncertainty and start allowing a bit more trade and investment to flow. I think that part of the picture with the UK economy writ large is that no one can tell how pessimistic or optimistic to be right now. You're basically throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what will stick in terms of your forecasts. Because this is such an unusual environment, you've had the trade uncertainty from Brexit. You've had a lot of political and regulatory uncertainty, which might now be starting to settle down a little bit. But you've also had this inflationary problem and a lot of uncertainty about what the policy response to that is going to be and the effects that it will have. So in that sense, it's probably not surprising that people have no idea what the future is holding at this point, because they keep struggling to absorb all of these little bits of data and policy developments that you wouldn't ordinarily anticipate in any of your traditional models.
And the news about the recession, I want to connect to that because that may point to a road on this side. We had very upsetting inflation news last week, the PCE, which you can explain. And today they have very upsetting inflation news in Europe. Spanish inflation is up. French inflation is up. Germans are, I believe, trading their 10-year bond around the place where they were trading, or at least as bad as 2011. Not quite sure how to interpret that, but 2011 was not a good year for all of Europe. And the ECB, European Central Bank, is said to be ready to go to all-time highs for interest rates. Is that all good news, Joe? Does that connect with this prediction of avoiding a recession?
Well, again, it's hard to know how to interpret any of this at the moment, partly because the central banks themselves are a big moving part, and no one is entirely sure how high they are going to end up raising interest rates in order to try to fight the inflation. And it's very difficult to say what the consequences of that might be for the economy. So my sense is that part of the optimism in the UK is that the Bank of England has been raising interest rates pretty dramatically over the past year, and that does not quite seem to be weighing on the economy yet in the way that people would have expected. And then there is also some hope that energy prices might start coming down, which would be an enormous relief to businesses and households if, in fact, that comes to fruition over the next year. But again, all of these variables are very difficult to predict. You also have this new sense of optimism about trading relations with the EU after the new Brexit deal this week, and yet a lot of uncertainty about the health of that trading partner, because, as you pointed out, the Eurozone is continuing to struggle with inflation, and no one knows what they're going to have to do to successfully tamp it down. So again, I'm finding it very difficult to make any sense of anyone's economic predictions at the moment, just because there are so many moving parts going on here, and they are all moving in ways that are very unusual compared to history.
The announcement of the recession, it begins to resemble that very famous title from the Great Depression, Waiting for Godot, which I'll remind everybody is a theater piece in which our one-man show spends the time on the stage musing about when will Godot show up. Well, that's what the recession feels like. Now UK is saying maybe we'll avoid the recession. that same kind of talk has already started in Europe, on the mainland as well. So I bring everything home. I think entirely from this side of the Atlantic, and I ask for Joseph's perspective in London. Can we avoid the recession with this monetary policy driven by the Federal Reserve? And also because we're having an easy time with the hiring. We're not laying off thousands of people, and people who are laid off get jobs again. In fact, we're told now there isn't such a crunch for employees as there were. There was a headline saying CEOs are finding it easier to find good people to hire. Is that all going to contribute to us avoiding the recession, Joe? Does that add up?
Well, I am a bit more optimistic about the U.S. avoiding a recession now than I might have been a little while ago, partly because, several factors. I mean, first off, as you point out, despite a bit of, signs of changing and, a little bit of weakness, there's still a lot of signs that the labor market is holding up pretty well, despite the monetary tightening. And even more important so far, the Fed has been able to tighten monetary policy without triggering a financial crisis of some sort. And that was really always the big worry. I mean, the Fed will talk about its tightening as if the way it slows the economy is by tamping down on aggregate demand in the labor market. But increasingly over recent decades, the real thing that the Fed tends to do is tighten until they trigger a financial crisis. And then the financial crisis is the thing that causes the economic slowdown and ultimately triggers disinflation or moderating inflation. So I think the thing that we have to hope for is that the Fed this time finds some way of bringing inflation under control without triggering a financial crisis. And they are nearly a year into this tightening cycle and have managed to walk that tightrope so far. So fingers crossed that they keep doing it.
You have written, and the Wall Street Journal has written very carefully about Jerome Powell's leadership of the Federal Reserve. And there were large questions asked because of the long, long pause the Federal Reserve to move against these almost zero interest rates. And Jerome Powell has consistently, since he started raising rates last summer, the jumbo hikes of 22 and followed by the hike in February, and we're told there's going to be one in March, has been consistent in saying, I will stay the course, 2% is my target. Has he redeemed himself in your eyes, Joseph? Has he convinced people that he means what he says and that 2% is his target? Or are there still doubts out there that they'll change their mind and raise that target?
Well, he has convinced markets and other observers so far, but there is a key caveat to that. So I think that he has increased interest rates more aggressively and to a higher level than people probably expected that he would. And so that has been very good for his credibility. But he has been helped by the fact that this has not actually triggered a downturn in the labor market or a broader recession yet. The great unknown is whether he will stick to his determination to get inflation under control if we do end up stumbling into some kind of economic slowdown, because that's the point where he will be coming under increasing political pressure to let up in the fight against inflation before that is won for the sake of trying to boost employment. Now, look, I think theoretically there are a lot of problems with that kind of argument. And I think that both sides of that fight would probably be wrong in various ways, but that is going to be the reality of the political pressure that he will come under. It is only at that moment, if it comes, that we will really understand how credible he has become.
Now I put together our original conversation about the war in Europe, not only the military war, but the energy war, combined with the present circumstances of the economy in UK, in Europe, and the US. And it's a what if, Joseph, but it's based upon conversations that were held at the Munich conference and afterwards that were reported that London, Paris, and Berlin are leaning towards Kiev to get to the peace talks, to get to something that looks like an accommodation for both sides and a ceasefire. It's in the wind. And then the Chinese brought forward their peace proposal, which Moscow initially dismissed, as did Kiev and Brussels, but now we're told Moscow is taking another look. That peace proposal was simple: ceasefire, sanctions relief, and peace talks. What would that mean for the markets, for this recession fear, a ceasefire and a peace talks in Ukraine?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because I think that certainly if you had asked that question on February 25th last year, the day after the war started, people would have told you that a ceasefire or peace negotiations would be very good for the economy, because that would avoid the need for energy sanctions on Russia and would allow Europe to continue accessing cheap fossil fuels from Russia. Now, what has changed over the past year is that I'm not sure that that is true, even if now there were a ceasefire of some sort, let alone a negotiated settlement, because I think that Europe has understood that they cannot risk going back to their previous dependence on Russia. So they are going to have to continue paying more for energy from more sources, moving forward for the foreseeable future. So because of that, I think it becomes a little difficult to peg what the economic implications would be of a peace agreement at this point, other than it would potentially reduce uncertainty more generally.
And so you don't see a VE Day or a VJ celebration. The war's over. We can get back to building and prosperity and marriage. You don't see anything like that.
Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out that this would also potentially be very controversial within Western European countries, where some portion of the electorate in a lot of places has really come to feel very strongly supportive of Ukraine, and I think would be wary of their governments pushing Ukraine too far toward peace prematurely if Ukraine were not negotiating clearly from a position of strength. So I think that there is an interesting sense in which negotiations would potentially solve a lot of problems for Western European leaders, but might also risk creating some interesting and unpredictable political problems for them too.
One more turn of the screw. There is talk that Bakhmut is turning into a Ukrainian defeat, or at least not a victory. There is talk that Ukraine is hard-pressed for ammunition supplies, as are the Russians, and hard-pressed for soldiers. The attrition rate on both sides, I don't have it, but it's said to be very large. In the event that Ukraine must concede, not lose, but must concede in some fashion, is that a positive or a negative for Europe, for Russia to claim victory?
Well, I think that the key point, if you're going to have any sort of peace negotiation that would be successful for Europe over the longer term, the key thing is that it has to be structured in such a way that is going to strongly deter Vladimir Putin from any of this imperial adventurism or expansionism in the future. And so that means that it really is in NATO's interest and Europe's interest that Ukraine enter those negotiations from a position of strength. So that can mean either right now accelerating the delivery of military aid to Ukraine to try to forestall some kind of disaster or setback in Bakhmut, or it means that if there is a setback at this stage, the West needs to be prepared to invest in helping the Ukraine to notch up some wins on the board in other places before they go to the table.
Joseph Sternberg, he's in London for the Wall Street Journal editorial board, commenting on a couple of what-ifs that are in the wind but not on the table about Ukraine conflict. We're going to turn to life in London because at the end of February, the beginning of March, there is rumor of spring. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
What happened to her, Mario? How could she simply disappear after she was with you?
I don't have answers for that.
48 Hours at CBS News present.
I'm just going to ask you straight out. Did you kill Christy Wilson?
No, I had nothing to do with her disappearance.
Another season of My Life of Crime with Erin Moriarty. Award-winning correspondent Erin Moriarty brings you face-to-face with killers.
I will never say that I'm a cold-blooded killer. I will never say I'm a murderer.
And the people they took from.
My son died running for his life.
This season, follow the evidence with Erin beyond the speculation, including in the death of boxing legend Arturo Gatti.
My gut says I don't think he would take his life.
I know. My husband killed himself.
Listen to My Life of Crime from 48 Hours on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Mo Rocca, and it's been a while. But I've been busy digging up even more stories about the people and things of the past that are fascinating me now.
What did your father think of the label, of the whole idea of the Latin lover?
From the screen idols who redefined Hollywood's leading man.
I think it was a love-hate relationship. My dad hated the word macho.
That's what I call the Latin lover type of a role, which is one-dimensional.
To the dog who introduced millions of kids to classic literature.
I remember, like, on my 10th birthday, I think it was, we were going to go mini-golfing, and I insisted, but we had to stay home for Wishbone first.
Listen to Mobituaries wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to exclusive reporting from CBS News.
Join Gail King, Tony DeCopel, and Nate Burleson for original reporting. CBS Mornings, weekday mornings on CBS.